Hi everyone, it's Stu here, your dulcet-toned podcast host. Are you tired of ads interrupting your favourite true crime podcast? British Murders, of course. I mean, who needs a 60-second detour when you're in the midst of an immensely well-told story? The irony of this being an ad isn't lost on me, but I wanted to let you know that you can listen to British Murders completely ad-free by signing up for a Patreon membership. For as little as £3 per month, you'll get early access to ad-free episodes, as well as a heap of other benefits. I've got a fair few bonus episodes you can sink your teeth into, and every Monday I drop a new episode of the British Murders Weekly Journal. If you enjoy exclusive giveaways, my Patreon has those too. Head to patreon.com/britishmurders and choose either my OBE or KBE/DBE tier to rid yourself of those pesky adverts. Plus, you'll be helping support your favourite podcast so that I can offer you even more content going forward. I'd say that I'll shut up now, but you've got the rest of the episode to listen to. Back to you, Stu.
This podcast contains elements that may be alarming to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
You are now listening to British Murders, the True Crime Podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome to British Murders, the podcast focusing exclusively on listener-suggested British murder cases. I'm your host Stuart Blues and this is the first episode of season 13. Can you believe it? 1-3. Is it unlucky 13? We will see. Before we get into the story, let's break the ice. As always, the show's first opening icebreaker segment is this.
True facts that sound like bullshit.
Did you know it's actually illegal to be drunk in a pub? Section 12 of the Licensing Act 1872 outlaws every person found drunk in a highway or other public place, whether a building or not, or on any licensed premises. Now it's time for the show's final opening icebreaker segment.
Random quote of the day.
Never put off till tomorrow what you can do the day after tomorrow just as well. Mark Twain. This case was requested via email by Andy in Australia. We're in the village of Dogmersfield this week, located in the southeast county of Hampshire. It's located 9 miles east of Basingstoke, 14 miles south of Reading, and 37 miles southwest of London. Here are a couple of quickfire facts about Dogmersfield. Number one, Henry VIII's elder brother Arthur, Prince of Wales, and his bride, Catherine of Aragon, are said to have stayed in the village at one point. And number two, the land where the manor is located, we'll come on to that soon, was recorded in the Domesday Book of 1086 as Dochmere Feld. I struggled to find any more facts apart from those two, but there are a fair few tidbits spread throughout the episode. According to the 2011 census, the estimated population of Dogmersfield was 279, so it really is a tiny little village. I'm going to begin this story with a bit of family history. I went down one hell of a rabbit hole during my research, which took me all the way back to the late 18th century. The Bigwither family has had roots in the Hampshire village of Wootton St. Lawrence for almost half a millennium. I compiled a simple family tree online so that I could get my bearings and understand the relationship between Karina Bigwither, whose story I'm telling in this episode, and some of her ancestors. Harris Bigwither Esquire was Karina's great-great-great-granddad. He lived from 1781 to 1833, but he became famous in 1802 at the age of roughly 21, when he proposed to none other than novelist Jane Austen on December 2nd of that year. Known worldwide for such works as Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice, Jane found herself accepting Harris's proposal, but shocked everyone the following morning when she told her husband-to-be that she'd changed her mind. She then swiftly left the grounds of Manydown Park in the company of her brother and sister. Manydown Park was the name of the ancient manor which housed the Bigwither family for hundreds of years before it was demolished in 1965. Only the stables, coach house and outbuildings remain to this day. Also of note in Karina's family tree is her great-great-great-uncle Charles Bigwither, the youngest of Harris's sons, who was appointed as a member of the New Zealand Legislative Council in 1863, but resigned during that same year without actually taking his seat. I was interested in finding out whether the family has a deep military background, but it doesn't appear to. Karina's granddad, Guy Bigwither, served as a lieutenant at HMS Dolphin, also known as Fort Blockhouse, which was the historic home of the Royal Navy's submarine service until January 2020. Her dad, Richard Bigwither, joined the Royal Navy as a Fleet Air Arm Pilot, and he received the Distinguished Service Cross. He got that for his undaunted courage, skill and determination in carrying out attacks on the German battleship Tirpitz during the Second World War offensive known as Operation Goodwood. Karina was born in roughly 1957 to Richard and his wife Priscilla, maiden name Moore Smith, and I'm assuming they at first lived in Wootton St Lawrence. One source claimed Karina was born in Berkshire though, so I can't say for sure where she spent her formative years. Sibling-wise, Karina had a couple of older half-sisters, Alexandra or Sandra being the eldest, and Joanna being the middle child. Joanna, known professionally as Joanna Moore Smith, would move to Australia and star as Laura Denham slash Phillips in the Australian soap opera The Young Doctors between 1976 and 1980. Growing up, the three siblings were close and everyone in the local community knew and liked them. When Karina was about 9, the family moved to a property called Wellwaters in the village of Dogmersfield. Located off Chatter Alley, 12 miles east of the Bigwither family's home village, the luxury 17th century cottage, complete with its own tennis court, provided a wonderful setting for the siblings to enjoy what remained of their childhoods. Karina has been described as being the sort of child every parent wants. She was happy, rarely got into bother, and gratefully returned the love she was shown by her parents. She attended a private school in Hertfordshire called St Christopher, and based on the fact it was located 70 miles northeast of the family's cottage, I assume she boarded there. The annual fees were reportedly in excess of £4,000 a year, which equates to almost 12.5 grand today. Taking her education seriously, but ultimately not knowing what she wanted to do with her life career-wise, she found it difficult to remain at one place of employment for an extended period. She tried her hand at being a waitress, did the door-to-door rounds for Avon, as so many women did in the 70s, but couldn't put her finger on what her passion was. Her restlessness perhaps came from wanting to help others rather than focusing on herself. As she grew older, Karina's good-willed nature and kind-heartedness would become more and more prevalent. Always want to offer help and support to those in far less fortunate situations than her, she regularly saw herself in the company of such people. One of her friends would later look back on Karina's altruistic tendencies by saying, "She was always sorry for misfits and showed them remarkable sympathy. She attracted insecure people. They came to her like a magnet." Where exactly such selflessness stems from is unclear. As an adult, Karina lived in an annex off the side of her parents' cottage, which was essentially a self-contained flat. One of Karina's friends was a woman called Belinda, who lived just under 6 miles east of her on Southampton Street in the nearby town of Farnborough. Belinda extended an invitation to Karina in the late summer of 1983 because she was hosting a barbecue at her house. Accepting, Karina had no idea how significant the seemingly mundane event would go on to become, because it was there where she met the person who would go on to take her life at the age of 26. Ian Haywood was born and raised in the Hampshire town of Aldershot in about 1964. His parents had 3 children in total, all boys, of which Haywood was the eldest. I'm unsure of his dad's name, but his mum, Jacqueline, worked as a radio operator for a taxi company and was left to raise the 3 boys on her own after separating from her husband when Haywood was just 5 years old. The 4 of them continued their lives living in a council house in the town, and given Haywood essentially grew up without a father, he developed a huge chip on his shoulder. I can't speak with certainty as to how involved his dad was in his life, but based on the information available, it seems as though he wasn't present, or certainly wasn't a regular feature in his son's lives. Heywood grew up to be incredibly insecure, and as a teenager, his rebellious nature developed from simple disobedience to criminal activities. He would frequently steal cars in his neighbourhood and partook in joyriding, despite being 15, too young to actually acquire a driving licence. He spent a good period of his late teenage years in detention centres and borstals for his petty crimes, but in February 1982, his crimes escalated further. The first and seemingly only criminal offence Heywood received as an adult prior to this story's events came on the back of him assaulting someone. Details around what happened and to what degree are not readily available, but to me, it's clear he had a penchant for violence and would quickly become aggressive if things didn't go his way. Working backwards, Heywood and his girlfriend Pia were excited at the prospect of becoming parents when she fell pregnant in roughly June 1981. Heywood was in a borstal at the time, but the pair always saw each other when he was granted day release, hence she soon became pregnant. Pia was the same age as Heywood, and if we fast forward 9 months to March 1982, they welcomed their baby to the world. Bizarrely, not long after the birth of their child, the pair split up, and if you can believe it, both went on to quickly marry other people. Pia seems to have followed a similar path to Heywood during her late teenage years, and owing to a complete lack of guidance, she also got in trouble with the law, although to what extent, again, it's not known. You can probably tell this is one of them stories with plenty of unanswered questions due to a complete lack of resources. Still, Karina's story is one that deserves to be told, so let's push on. Both Pia and Heywood's respective marriages appear to have been done on impulse, because both of them broke down rather quickly. Heywood's lasted just 3 weeks, and before long, the two teenage parents rekindled their relationship. They ended up living in room 1 of the Fleet Hotel, accommodation supposedly supplied by Fleet Town Council. At Belinda's summer barbecue, Karina was introduced to Heywood, a mutual friend, and for most of the afternoon, the pair sat together talking about their respective lives. Heywood had had a completely opposite upbringing when compared to Karina, and based on what we know about her personality, it makes sense as to why she listened intently to what Heywood had to say. When evening arrived and the event finished, the pair said a fond farewell, having planned to meet up soon over lunch to get to know each other more and continue their newfound friendship. I must stress that, as far as Karina was concerned, Heywood was not someone she wanted to be in a relationship with him. She wasn't attracted to him, didn't get butterflies when he spoke with her. She simply wanted to offer her friendship to someone in need, as she so often did. Within a few weeks, the pair had met up for the planned lunch after Karina passed a message to Belinda, who in turn passed it on to Heywood. After the meal, the two of them walked along a stretch of water, likely either the River Hart or the canal that runs close to it, and continued to chat away. It's safe to say the pair got on well, but Karina was a bit put off by Heywood's supposed immaturity. He was 19, remember, and although he was technically an adult, based on his background that makes sense regarding his personality. He was 7 years Karina's junior, so his lack of maturity likely stood out even more so than usual to someone of her age. It may have been that same evening when Karina invited Heywood over to her house, but if not, the date was September 12, 1983. Richard and Priscilla were out of the country, and even though Karina had her own place to live separate from the main house, she and Heywood would be the only two people there. After his career in the Navy finished, Richard became a leather trader running his own business. The trip to Paris was business related, as his company had secured a stand to showcase their goods and services at the renowned Semont International de Cours, which translated from my very good French means International Leather Week. It's an annual event run by the National Leather Council of France, and Priscilla naturally supported her husband by going with him. When it came time for bed at the cottage that evening, Heywood was made up an area of the living room floor whilst Karina retired to her bed. Nothing eventful happened throughout the night, but the following morning that would all change. Waking up earlier than his host, Heywood saw an opportunity. The cottage was decorated with plenty of luxury items that he could easily steal and sell on for a quick bit of cash. The only problem was that Karina woke up earlier than expected and caught Hayward in the act. Not quite believing what she was seeing, given how generous she'd been by offering the troubled Hayward a place to stay for the night, Karina was unable to react in any other way than by lambasting her guest. Let's be fair, I think we'd all have reacted exactly how Karina did in that situation. As she shouted at Hayward and ordered him to return the items he'd already taken before getting out, the 19-year-old suddenly flipped and lunged towards Karina, grabbing her by the throat with both hands. Seeing red, he attempted to strangle his host there and then, but somehow Karina slipped free of his grasp and ran quickly outside into the garden. Catching up with her in no time, the much faster and stronger Hayward grabbed Karina's arm, restraining her and thwarting her escape. Spotting a lawnmower close by, it was that piece of equipment he was interested in. Laying next to the mower was a machete, something commonly used to clear shrubs and brambles in gardens. Using the blunt side of the weapon, Hayward struck Karina in the neck, face and body repeatedly, knocking her to the ground in the process. Floating in and out of consciousness and unable to move, Karina was then attacked with the sharp side of the machete. Hayward would later imply that he was doing Karina a favour after the beating he'd just given her. His belief was that by killing her, he was putting her out of her misery.
The story will continue after these quick messages. And now, back to the story.
Hiding her body in a nearby bush on the grounds, Hayward returned to loading his car with items from the cottage, including a sword, some of Richard's medals, three tellies, a fur coat, and several electrical goods. Having driven there the night before, Hayward appears to have loaded both his car and Karina's blue Mini Metro, because it was the latter that he drove back to the hotel where he and Pyre were staying. Pyre had no idea where he'd been for the last 2 days, because he just disappeared, as he so often did, but nevertheless, she, along with her friend Lisa, helped Hayward unload Karina's car and drop the items off in their room. By all accounts, Pyre were more concerned about where Hayward had been than the contents of the car. Lisa was then asked to accompany Hayward back to the cottage so they could retrieve his car. She then drove his car back to the hotel whilst he continued to drive Karina's. Neither woman had any idea what he'd done, by the way. They just appear to have been following orders. On the same day their daughter was killed, Richard and Priscilla returned home from their trip. Arriving in the evening, they noticed that Karina was not around, which they at first thought odd given she'd known when they were due home, but at the same time she frequently stayed away from the house with friends, so perhaps they figured that's where she was. What Karina's parents did notice was the missing items that Hayward had stolen from them. Informing the police, Richard and Priscilla were visited by local officers who explained they would do their utmost to catch whoever was responsible and return their treasured possessions. The officers didn't stay long given the time of day, but explained they would return the following morning to continue their investigation. As they searched the grounds of the cottage, Richard joined them, and it was he who stumbled across the discovery of Karina's badly mutilated body at around midday. I can't begin to imagine how utterly horrifying that must have been for him. She had as many as 16 devastating injuries to her head alone, with the rest of her body being both badly bruised and covered in cuts from the machete. The seemingly simple burglary case had just escalated into a murder inquiry. Within a few hours, Hayward was arrested after being spotted driving around the village in Karina's stolen car. When told what he was being charged with, Hayward initially denied any knowledge of what had happened, although before long he is said to have confessed to having killed Karina. Pyre was also arrested and taken in for questioning, as the police believed she had assisted Hayward by retaining the stolen goods for his benefit. All the stolen goods were subsequently found in the hotel room where Hayward and Pyre were staying and were returned to their rightful owners. Pyre explained that Hayward came and went as he pleased, and although she admitted to having handled stolen goods, she technically didn't know they were stolen at the time, and she certainly wasn't aware that her partner had murdered someone. With no prior convictions, Pyre would later be placed on probation for 12 months in December 1983 and was fined £20 in costs, roughly £65 in today's money. 3 months before her sentencing, Karina was laid to rest in the cemetery at Wootton St. Lawrence's Parish Church, where many other members of her family also lay. As for Haywood, his murder trial commenced in May 1984. I say trial, it was more of a hearing, because Haywood had already pleaded guilty to murder and did so at Winchester Crown Court. Lasting just 20 minutes, the hearing ended with the judge handing Haywood a life sentence. His mum, Jacqueline, was quoted in the papers at the time saying, "I think I know how the Bigwither family feel. I know how I would feel if it was my daughter, but Ian is my son, so I have a loyalty to him. He is a completely different person." That last part is Jacqueline referring to how Haywood came across during her weekly visits whilst he was on remand. Our story doesn't end there, however. Haywood, who was a notorious womaniser by the way, went on to meet a woman called Anne while he was serving his prison sentence. Meeting Haywood in 1992, Anne was a voluntary prison counsellor and soon fell in love with the convicted murderer. She knew he'd murdered someone, but for context, Haywood had told Anne that he'd murdered his stepfather on account of him being abusive. Anne seems to have had no idea that her new love interest had killed an innocent woman who, despite basically being a stranger, had taken him in out of the goodness of her heart. Just 2 years into their relationship, Anne and Haywood got married. Before long, he was granted a series of day release passes before finally being released from prison in December 1998. He and Anne would have a total of 4 children together, but even that wouldn't stop Haywood from reoffending. By then living in a house in the West Sussex village of Hurstpierpoint, Haywood had secured a role as a lorry driver, but when he lost the job, the family began to really struggle financially. That set off in Haywood a downward spiral that saw him revert to womanising, before committing an act so heinous in 2001 that it would see him recalled to prison for good. On January 18th of that year, the now 36-year-old headed for Ditchling Common County Park, a picturesque woodland beauty spot close to an area known as the South Downs. It was a common place for courting couples to spend time together, and that evening, Haywood spotted a couple of teenagers, 17 and 19 years old respectively, sat in a car in the parking area. I'll not be naming either of the two teens, simply because their names have been omitted from all reports for legal reasons, but the 17-year-old girl was a college student. The 19-year-old was her boyfriend. Wearing a balaclava and holding both a gun and a sharp knife, Haywood emerged from his hiding place and took the couple by surprise. Demanding money whilst pointing the gun at them, Haywood felt they were reacting too slowly, which led to him firing the gun in the air as a warning for them to hurry up. Wanting to remove the boyfriend from the situation, Haywood struck him on the head with the butt of the gun before placing him inside the boot of the car and then locking it so he couldn't escape or help his girlfriend. The terrified 17-year-old insisted that she had no money, which led to Haywood ordering her to strip at gunpoint. What followed next was an assault on the girl that she took as being an attempt to rape her, which naturally caused her to resist and fight back. Doing so angered Haywood to such an extent that he began violently assaulting her with the knife, stabbing her a reported 35 times in total. The girl said of the attack, "I curled up into a ball. He leant forward and I felt the first stab. He did it another 2 times and then I went numb. He just kept going and going." To this day, she has scars on her hands and face, a persistent physical reminder of that horrendous evening. The thing that saved her life was when she kicked Haywood so hard in the balls, he fell over backwards. The knife he used on the girl snapped away from the handle as he fell, leaving him without his preferred weapon of choice. Playing dead, the girl thankfully escaped with her life as Haywood decided not to continue his assault and stumbled away clutching his privates. The 19-year-old had managed to free himself from the boot by escaping out the back of the car. He'd managed to put the back seats down and climb out. The couple were then taken to Princess Royal Hospital in West Sussex by some of their friends who arrived at the car park not long after the attack. The girl's injuries were so severe she would later require 143 stitches, with the doctors who worked on her saying the injuries were some of the worst they'd ever seen. Heywood had miraculously not nicked any major blood vessels in the girl's neck, with the blows to her chest being protected by her ribs. Weeks of physical therapy followed for the 17-year-old, owing to her having a couple of surgeries to repair the tendons in her hands. Luckily, a plastic surgeon was present when she arrived at the hospital. I say it's lucky because it wasn't meant to be there that night. He'd swapped a shift at the last minute, which essentially led to the girl's hands being saved. Detective Sergeant Chris Standard was one of 10 detectives tasked with catching Heywood, although they didn't know it was him initially. Dubbed Operation Angler, DS Standard said of the brief hunt, "It was an irrational and very, very frightening attack with no real motive. This young couple were complete strangers to him. It was such a motiveless and horrific assault that we did not know what he was capable of doing." Within a day of the attack, Heywood was in custody. After arriving home, he confessed what he'd done to Anne, who duly informed the police the following morning. Heywood then voluntarily walked into Brighton Police Station after spotting a TV news bulletin which named him as being wanted by police in connection with the attack. When his trial commenced in January 2002, the jury were not informed of his previous murder conviction so as not to prejudice them. Even so, they unanimously found him guilty of attempted murder, attempted rape, false imprisonment, and two offences of attempted robbery. Heywood did his utmost to try and blame Anne for trying to frame him, that's his words, owing to her having mental health problems. Anne admitted to the jury that she had previously suffered from a multiple personality disorder, but that was back in 1996. Handing Heywood five separate life sentences to be served concurrently, Judge Graham Ball recommended in his closing statement that he never be released, such was the danger he posed to the public. The judge went on to say, "You have been convicted on overwhelming evidence of appalling crimes. You subjected that young couple to a truly horrendous ordeal. The facts of these offences must rank among the gravest, short of murder itself." The 17-year-old's dad said after Heywood's sentencing, "All the family are relieved and delighted that justice has been done. This attack should never have happened. The system had allowed this murderer back into society to reoffend. These events are happening too often. The government needs to sit up and urgently review the handling of these callous and vicious people." As for the 17-year-old, she said, "The most support I got was from my brother, my mum and my dad. They were with me all the time. They had to cut my food and help me go to the toilet. I couldn't make my own drink or hold the kettle. I couldn't hold my knife and fork properly, and I used to get so angry." To this day, she suffers from panic attacks and is receiving regular counselling. And that was the story of the murder of Karina Bigwither. Thanks again, Andy, for requesting it. I'd love to hear everyone's thoughts. This week's new reviews are as follows. Naomi Jones recommended British Murders on Facebook by saying, "Brilliant podcast, interesting, well-researched cases. I love Stuart's voice and delivery. Fab show all round." Dana K. Mills left a 5-star review on BritishMurders.com. It reads, "Howdy from the US. I found your podcast as I have just recently become an Elementary fan, a series here based on Sherlock Holmes starring Johnny Lee Miller. I have grown a fondness for him and therefore searched for a true crime podcast hosted by someone with the same accent. There are a couple, but none of them were attractive. Sorry to whomever they are. So finally I found a podcast with a lovely voice and a lovely face to picture while I listen. I do watch you on YouTube occasionally, but generally I listen while entering data for an entertainment company here on the left coast of America. 5 stars for the broadcast / podcast, and cheerio." God, I'm going to get some stick for that accent. But here's another one. Finally, Kimberly in Texas left a 5-star review on BritishMurders.com, which reads, "For the past 6 or so years, I've been listening to true crime podcasts from around the world, and I'm not sure how I missed this one. Luckily, I came across it a couple of months ago and soon found myself binging the old episodes and seasons. The research is thorough, delivery is succinct, smooth and informative, and Stu shows true compassion for the victims in a kind and respectful manner. I do love the pause cheerio at the end of each episode more than I should admit, and can't wait for new episodes to drop. Please keep up the good work you're doing, highlighting lesser known but equally important stories. Cheers from across the pond. P.S. Go Blues. Thank you, Naomi, Dana, and Kimberly, for leaving those reviews. I can only apologise for my horrific American accent there. If anyone listening wants to leave a review of the show and have it read on a future episode, you can do so on iTunes, Facebook, Podchaser, or at BritishMurders.com. You can also leave star ratings on Spotify. Please head to patreon.com/BritishMurders and sign up for either my OBE or CBE tier. You'll gain early and ad-free access to all future episodes, as well as several bonus episodes, regular giveaways, welcome goodies, and my British Murders Weekly Journal series. If you'd prefer to support the show on a one-off basis, you can do so by heading to buymeacoffee.com/BritishMurders. Please continue emailing case suggestions to contact@BritishMurders.com or message me via social media. You'll not only get the episode covered, but you'll get a cheeky shout-out for your trouble. And that's it for another episode. I've been Stuart Blues. This has been British Murders. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time. Cheerio.